We've produced a new CD of two sermons preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin, one for Lent and one for Easter. And we'll send you this new CD for any size donation during the season of Lent. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between now and April 12th, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Lent and Easter sermons.
We will restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders.
The gospel is not only the message that the church takes to the world, the gospel is the source of the church's very existence.
People have the attention span of hummingbirds on cocaine. It's got to feel good right now. And to some degree, that's the way we also think about church.
Southern Illinois truck drivers, love issues, etc.
These phrases become household usages. Activist judges. Unaccountable judges. Unaccountable courts. What does it all mean, and how did we get to the point where a lot of what people classify as the culture wars occurs in the courtroom, in front of, or in the studies of judges? You know, the judiciary is a good thing. It's one of the three branches of our government of checks and balances, but has the judiciary, as many have warned in the ancient world and today, become unaccountable without checks or balances? Is there a legal philosophy behind unaccountable courts? We'll be answering that question here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in this Tuesday afternoon. It's the 10th of March. Dr. Bradley Watson, author of the new book, Living Constitution, Dying Faith, will be our guest for the first half hour. 1-877-623-6943 is our phone number, 1-877-623-MYIE. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. After our conversation on the Constitution and the courts, Michael Spencer will join us to talk about the future of American evangelicalism. He's written an article for the Christian Science Monitor titled Coming Evangelical Collapse. Dr. Gilbert Mylander will join us. He's a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. We'll get his reaction to President Obama's announcement yesterday to allow federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. We'll do a little review of a sermon preached by Pastor George Borghardt on Ash Wednesday, a sermon review a little bit later in the program, and then listen to some of your comments on the Issues Etc. comment line to round off today's program. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, or talk back at issuesetc.org. Dr. Bradley Watson is a former litigation attorney, chair in American and Western political thought at St. Vincent College based in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and author of the new book, Living Constitution, Dying Faith. Dr. Watson, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. It's great to be with you.
You have written that the judiciary, and in particular the Supreme Court, has become the locus of the culture wars. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. Of course, if courts just stuck to the kinds of things that common law courts have traditionally stuck to, you know, adjudicating concrete disputes between parties, commercial disputes, criminal matters, and so forth, the courts would be the least controversial, most respected branch of our government. But really, commencing in the early part of the 20th century, courts started to come under the spell of this new progressive ideology, which grew out of Darwinism and pragmatism, the view that everything had to change, had to evolve to keep up with the times, and that included even our Constitution. And under the influence of this ideology, courts have taken it upon themselves, really, to tell the American people where they should be going and what they should be preferring on these controversial cultural questions, ranging from abortion to homosexuality, every hot-button cultural issue you can think of. Courts are at the cutting edge of change on this these things, regardless of what the people actually choose.
I want to come back to the Darwinian and, as you say, philosophical pragmatism as the roots of this, but let's get a definition. You talk about progressivism as a legal theory. How would you describe it to a classroom of law students?
Yeah, progressivism is the view that, at least as applied by judges, is the view that the Constitution Constitution is not about the words that our founders wrote down. Constitutional interpretation is not about reading those words and trying to get a sense of what the founders meant by them. Constitutional interpretation really is about keeping the Constitution up with the times, making sure it, like everything else in society, progresses appropriately. So what's the best body to ensure that this change happens? Well, in the view of the progressive thinkers, it is the courts, because you don't need democratic consent. You don't need to go to the people. You don't need to get their agreement. You can simply go to the courts, find a good judge on the sort of on the cutting edge of elite opinion, and you get your will written into law that way. It's quick and it's relatively painless compared to convincing your fellow citizens of things.
So we're talking here about a view of the Constitution as inspiration for today rather than as a text to be interpreted as still binding, still kind of transcendentally true for everyone today.
The Constitution is viewed under progressive legal dogma as an empty vessel into which we can pour our contemporary passions and prejudices. So, it kind of provides pegs on which you can hang your legal hat, as it were. But really, the words themselves and the understandings of those words that the people of the founding generation had are not the key things. The key thing is getting to where we want to go and using the Constitution to justify that.
All right, then. What of the will and the intent of the founders, and in particular the framers of the Constitution? What becomes of that in this progressive legal theory?
The words of our founders are actually, I think, not that important. The words of the Constitution are not that important. I play a little game with my students every time I teach these kinds of things. I ask them, for example, on the abortion question, how many times is the word privacy mentioned in the Constitution? Answer, zero. How many times is abortion mentioned in the Constitution? Answer, zero. So where does the alleged constitutional right to abortion come from, which in turn is purportedly based on the right to privacy? Where does that come from? Well, it clearly doesn't come from the Constitution's text or anything our founders were explicitly contemplating when they wrote that text. It comes from the minds of nowadays, I think, five of the nine justices of the current Supreme Court. In other words, one person, one swing vote is determining the law for the rest of us, despite the expressed wishes of the American people. And it's like this on a host of cultural questions. So what happens to the words of our founders? Basically, they are used to justify, as I say, our contemporary passions, or I shouldn't say our, the passions of the liberal elites who dominate the law schools and, in some cases, the federal bench. And, it's what they want those words to mean rather than what the words actually meant to the people who wrote them.
Let's go back then. It uses a case study, 36 years, Roe v. Wade, where it was argued by the majority of the court that, or it was concluded by the majority of the court, I should say. They didn't argue it. Well, actually, they did. They don't have any business arguing it, but they did anyway. That the right to privacy was there in the Constitution in the emanations and penumbra thereof. How would you, if you were standing in front of that court in 1973, how would you have argued there?
Yeah, it's a great phrase, isn't it? Emanations and penumbras from actual constitutional provisions. In other words, the Constitution doesn't actually say it. The fact of the matter is, of course, had I been there, I would have pointed out that the Constitution says nothing about this question. Emanations and penumbras is an interesting phrase, but it's a phrase that came out of another Supreme Court case decided just a few years before Roe versus Wade. It's not in the Constitution either. It's purely a judicial invention. Now, of course, I wouldn't have gotten a very good hearing back then in 1973 when the courts claimed that, again, in order to be on the cutting edge of social change, it was up to them to tell the American people what they were entitled to legislate on, in this case abortion, and what they are not entitled to legislate on, really regardless of the intentions of our founders. And this is what I call in my book Living Constitution, the living Constitution model of constitutional interpretation. The Constitution itself is interpreted as an organic entity along Darwinian lines, something that must evolve, must grow, must change, or essentially stagnate and die. And it's the job of the judiciary, in the view of these progressives, to make sure that change keeps going. And the people don't have much say in it, unfortunately.
You've said that the two roots here, as you just mentioned, a Darwinist view, a worldview, and a philosophical pragmatism. With about a minute and a half before our first break, start with the connection to a Darwinist worldview and what we have today in this new jurisprudence.
Yeah, it's very little understood. And one of the things my book does is try to elucidate this. I mean, of course, we know that Darwin affected the way we view biological entities. The essential claim of Darwinism is that biological entities evolve; they change. They are not creatures of a certain species and rank with certain natural rights. Everything is changing. Everything is kind of up for grabs according to the dictates of the evolutionary process. That was applied not only to biological organisms, but to politics and to the Constitution itself by the so-called social Darwinists who applied Darwinian concepts to society. And it's something that's been lost sight of. And contemporary legal progressives are carrying on in that tradition, that everything is up for grabs, everything changes, everything evolves, even the Constitution itself.
We're talking with Dr. Bradley Watson, former litigation attorney and chair of American and Western Political Thought at St. Vincent College, based in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, author of the new book, Living Constitution, Dying Faith. What kind of questions or comments do you have about an alleged living constitution? Give us a call or email us during this break. Our phone number this Tuesday afternoon, March the 10th, 1-877-623-6943, 1-877-623-MYIE, and our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about the so-called living constitution. We'll do a little bit more on the Darwinist social movement, and then talk about pragmatism. Sometimes you find out that the ethic is really utilitarian. The ends justify the means. By the way, you'll find information on Dr. Watson's new book, Living Constitution, Dying Faith, under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org.
International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the importance of issues, etc.
Before settling in England and France, I had my own Christian radio program for 10 years in California and 2 years in Washington State. I was also a regular for over a decade on national religious television. In a word, I have had a great deal of contact with evangelical programming, both good and bad, and my judgment in this area is probably worth something. In my opinion, Issues Etc. is one of the very few programs on Christian radio willing to discuss tough questions with solid theological answers. I consider it a great privilege to be able to appear on the program regularly, and I commend it to every serious listener.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Defending the faith, teaching the truth. Issues Etc.
Treadmill for the mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,600 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues Etc. Marianne Bell, Charles Horton, Mary Corte, Carta Horton, Glenda Goo, Alex Post, Dwayne Meyer, and Vicky Mastarka. Thanks for your support.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7, 618-223-8384.
I think it's a remarkable document, original Constitution, as well as the Civil War amendments, but I think it is an imperfect document, and I think it is a document that reflects some deep flaws in American culture the colonial culture nascent at that time. But I don't think the two views are contradictory to say that it was a remarkable political document that paved the way for where we are now, and to say that it also reflected the fundamental flaw of this country that continues to this day.
That, of course, is Barack Obama, before president, opining on some of what he called the flaws in the original Constitution. And it's interesting that he talks about the original Constitution paving the way for where we are today, as though it's kind of a road to be traveled and then eventually, I would assume, exited for something else. We're talking about contemporary jurisprudence. Dr. Bradley Watson is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Before the break, you were talking about Darwinism, social Darwinism, as a root of this new jurisprudence, and it dovetails right into the next cause that you talk about, which is American pragmatism. You say that for Darwin, the question of what something is in its essence became secondary to how it can be used or controlled. Explain that.
Yeah, you know, when the principle of human life and politics is a principle of transition, really, all focus is on, as I think you mentioned before the break, on utilitarianism. What works? How do we make it work best for our immediate wants, usually material wants? There's no effort to get to the essences of things. There's no effort to understand, for example, human beings as our founders understood them, as creatures of a certain type possessed of natural rights which do not change with time. The emphasis under Darwinian and pragmatic interpretations is always on the things that change as opposed to the things that don't change. We lose sight of essences. We're always engaged in trying to figure out the how question rather than the why question, if I can put it that way. And you know, we increasingly look to the courts to to answer those how questions for us. Look to the least Republican branch, the unelected judges, to tell us how to get to where they think we should go, as opposed to where our founders thought we should go in terms of protecting our natural rights, as I say, that do not change with time.
Oh, what becomes if the Constitution is viewed as to use a derogatory phrase, kind of the wax nose, then how is it explained that the framers of the Constitution permitted for amendment? I mean, if it's really intended just to be inspiration, you don't have to amend inspiration. But if it's intended to be a set framework, you do have to amend it if you're going to change your direction.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And of course, our founders understood that American society would change, we would change, public opinion would change, which is precisely why they built an amendment mechanism into the Constitution. It's also why they created Republican institutions, things like Congress that would be empowered to pass laws that had been deliberated on, laws that the people's representatives had carefully considered. But these things, the amendment mechanism and the laws that Congress or the state legislatures pass, become increasingly unimportant when you can simply get your will written into law by the Supreme Court saying, no, I'm sorry, Congress and the people are not entitled to do what they thought, what people have always thought up to, this Supreme Court case they were entitled to do.
Another question with the term is often used, you use it just a moment ago, unelected judges, and it's usually used nowadays as a kind of code word for they're accountable to no one from beginning to end, and it's nearly impossible to dislodge them. But I imagine that for the framers, the fact that judges were unelected was intended to be a good thing, not a bad thing. Talk about that.
An independent judiciary is one of the great gifts that America took from the English common law system. I mean, when we think about the Revolution, we think about things that changed in America, but some things didn't change. And one of the things that didn't change was the adoption of the English common law system in the United States. But the assumption was that courts would behave as common law courts traditionally behave. That is, they wouldn't go willy-nilly overturning the considered legislative judgments of Congress and the states. They would behave as English courts behave, that is to say, determine particular disputes brought before them and not purport to overturn Parliament's judgment on things.
So how far, by way of estimate, would you say law in the United States has strayed from the Constitution of the United States?
oh boy, that's a big question. I would say pretty far. And, you know, our courts, I think, do a pretty good job on a lot of matters. Some of them I mentioned at the top of the interview, things like ordinary commercial disputes. I think our courts are pretty fair. They dispense justice fairly well. I think criminal courts, for the most part, do a very good job in the United States. It is on the the hot button cultural issues, or when courts become political actors rather than judicial actors, that law starts to stray very far, I think, from our founders' intention. Now, as I say, they understood that society would change. People would want to pass different laws dealing with all sorts of things that they didn't imagine in the 18th century. But that's what lawmaking is about. It's designed to give us, the people, the capacity to make these determinations as circumstances change. The Constitution was never intended to be a kind of all-purpose set of roadblocks that would be placed in the way of the people making judgment on cultural questions. Homosexuality, abortion, same-sex marriage, these kinds of things, which increasingly courts are saying, no, you the people don't have a right to have any say in this. We're going to make that determination. And our founders wouldn't have recognized, I think, that Constitution.
You write, quoting apart another author, most fundamentally from a jurisprudential point of view, the progressives attacked the twin doctrines that most limited government power, federalism on the one hand, and protection of individual liberty and private property on the other hand. Describe that for us in terms we can understand.
Yeah. Well, federalism, of course, is the basic idea that the United States is not just it's not a unitary government. It's not composed only of the national government. In fact, all of the founders, I think, both Federalists and Anti-Federalists, that is to say, those who supported the Constitution and those who didn't, would be absolutely amazed at the size and scope of our federal government today. The federal principle that was intended to be enshrined in the Constitution, I think, has been almost entirely overcome with the acquiescence or active support of the judiciary, and the national government nowadays does essentially whatever it wants, almost without constitutional limits. So the federal principle, we look to the national government to solve all of our problems, and likewise the idea of individual rights, fixed individual rights, has itself fallen by the wayside as everything comes up for grabs under the new living constitution model. If the Constitution lives, then it surely can't, protect kind of fixed claims. It can't recognize a particular view of the human person, the dignity of the human person, and the kinds of relationships that are appropriate to creatures as we are created in the image and likeness of God. The Constitution has to change. In fact, the nature of human beings changes. What we once, the argument goes, thought was an abomination, now is just fine and dandy, and our Constitution should recognize it as fine and dandy. That's the view that everything, including even conceptions of human nature, is up for grabs, and the Constitution has to keep up with the change. In other words, Constitution doesn't set the meets and bounds of government. It just adapts all the time to keep up with altering social demands.
Very briefly, I've got two final questions. Does that mean that the notion of human dignity, human intrinsic worth, will of necessity change under this new jurisprudential theory?
Oh, I think it does, and I think if you read between the lines of some of these cases that have come at the state level on same-sex marriage, the alleged right to same-sex marriage based on very old constitutional documents, which clearly were not contemplating same-sex marriage, I think you can already make the argument that courts are reducing. Well, I more than make the argument; they say it explicitly. The Massachusetts court says, the essential thing about human relationships is choice. As long as you have consenting adults, they can do essentially whatever they want. In other words, that's just reducing essence to action and the idea of completely free, unfettered choice. Human beings aren't anything in particular. What comes next? My goodness, if it all comes down to choice, surely polygamy is next, bestiality, the list is endless.
Finally, then, with only about 30 seconds, some would argue that the Constitution was written by a bunch of white gentlemen, not a good representation of Americans today. Therefore, it does need to evolve. With 30 seconds for response.
Yeah, you know, I think our founders get a bum rap on a lot of things. I mean, the thing that's usually thrown up against them is the question of slavery. You know, to a man, our founders understood that the institution of slavery was incompatible with the natural rights that they believed in and that they attempted to enshrine in the Constitution. They also recognized that, you know, the facts on the ground were such that slavery existed. There was nothing they could do to eliminate it immediately, but they hoped that as the doctrines of natural rights spread, and as the Constitution took hold, eventually the way would be paved for the elimination of that institution. And, you know, I just don't buy the argument that because they were, you know, they're dead and old and white and male, that they've got nothing to teach us. They really had a very, I think, inspired conception of human beings and the kind of politics that would preserve human dignity and human natural rights.
Dr. Bradley Watson is a former litigation attorney, chair in American and Western political thought at St. Vincent College in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and author of the new book titled Living Constitution, Dying Faith. You'll find a link to that book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. Dr. Watson, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
Well, when we come back from this break, Michael Spencer is going to join us. He's written an article for the Christian Science Monitor titled The Coming Evangelical Collapse. We'll talk about the future of American evangelicalism. Right after this, I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology. And we'd like to send you the new Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, 1600 Gulfview Drive, Suite 230, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology, the new Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
In a packed courtroom, Walter Hoy stood before a judge. The judge asked, "Will you promise not to violate the stay-away order?" Walter Hoy is an African-American minister from Oakland, California, who was arrested for holding a sign in front of an abortion mill which read, "Jesus loves you and your baby. Let us help you." An Oakland ordinance forbids anyone from approaching within 100 feet of an abortion facility and within 8 feet of a client for the purpose of counseling, harassing, or interfering. I guess this includes holding a sign saying Jesus loves you. In the silence of the courtroom, Walter stood on the First Amendment and whispered his answer to the judge. "No, Your Honor. Walter Hoy is a brave and honorable man of God."
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,600 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues Etc. Shauna Gunnick, Jerry Korkenmeyer, Pastor Lance Armstrong O'Donnell, Bill Shim, Kristen Schulz, Joe Johnson, Christine Scott, Mitchell Day, Sue Peterson, and David Klinge. Thanks for your support.